These Romans, they don't hesitate to use the cross. Remember about 100 years ago when Spartacus and his fellow slaves rebelled. They crucified 6,000 of them. They lined those slaves up along the highway. Crucifixion is 120 miles long. These Romans, they don't hesitate to use this barbaric form of punishment. Oh, hi. Let me introduce myself. My name is Felix. I'm a Roman centurion here in Jerusalem. And my job is to oversee my soldiers and to help make sure we maintain the peace. And if necessary, we just cut out the cancers in society. And many times we use the cross. See, the Romans have told us to make sure that death by the cross is the most feared death in all of society. And so that's our job. It's sort of a way of keeping the criminals from acting out. We make death on the cross the most terrible death possible. We have people wishing for death even hours before they get to the cross. What we are allowed to do is something called scourging. And do you know what scourging is? Probably not. We chain a man's hands above his head. And I get two soldiers from my group, one on each side. And they take a whip, not a normal whip. It's a whip we call the cat of nine tails. It's a whip with many strands. And some of the end of those strands have heavy metal balls that when it's struck across the back and across the shoulders and the legs and the buttocks of the naked man, it tenderizes the flesh. Other strands in that whip have pieces of glass woven into it to cut, pieces of bone woven into it to infect, and pieces of metal that are in a hooked fashion. So when the whip comes across a back, it sinks into the flesh. And the soldier yanks it out. And after a few times, and the flesh is tender, the hooks sink deep and it tears out chunks of flesh. Then it even tears out muscles and tendons. And it's even been known to tear bones right off a man's body. As I said, we have people wishing for death even hours before they get to the cross. And then the cross, that's the worst form of death that we could ever conceive of. What we do is we take a man and we stretch him out on this piece of wood. We take one hand and we go right through his wrists, the most tender part of his body. We take 5 to 7 inch Roman spikes and we nail them into him. Then we take the other arm and nail it. Man's in agony, but we're not done with him yet. We've only begun. We give him a little foot post here. Now that may seem to you like a final mercy, that he can support his weight on the cross as he hangs there preparing to die, but actually it's a final act of brutality. Because you see, when his arms are stretched and the weight is from his body hangs in his arms, he can't breathe. So he can push himself up with the foot post and get some air into his lungs. But he's been scourged. He's been beaten, and some men die from the scourging. It is that bad. So he has no strength left in his legs, and what little strength he has, he pushes himself up, but soon he's weak. And he dangles over death, knowing that the moment he dies is because he is too weak to stand. Yeah, the footpost. It's actually a final act of cruelty that dangles a man over his own death. As I told you, our job is to make crucifixion as bad as possible. Criminals fear to act because criminals fear to die. Crucifixion, it brings everything out of a man. In fact, it brings out a man's heart. So when a man is beaten and when a man is crucified, what's really inside of them comes out. And we have heard men say some of the vilest and most evil and depraved things come out of their mouth in those moments when we crucify them. Now, even this is my job, and I don't like crucifying people, but I'll tell you, I feel like I'm doing my service to society because it's obvious that these people are cancers. Cancers that would seek to destroy us. So I feel like I'm doing my civic duty to eradicate them. I said that the cross brings out the true heart of a man. But there was a crucifixion a few years ago that went very differently from anything else I've been a part of. The other soldiers aren't here today. They're still coming. So before they come, could I tell you that story? I mean, it's a crucifixion that it changed me. Maybe if I tell you the story, it can change you. It took place during Passover a few years ago. We were handed over a man to be scourged. His name? Jesus of Nazareth. I had heard about him. We had been debriefed about him in our barrack debriefing a few weeks before. He was some kind of Jewish itinerant teacher. Rumor on the street was that he had performed a number of miracles. Supposedly, he had fed a large crowd with just a few loaves of bread and some fish. He had healed people that were sick. As for me, did I believe it? Of course not. Probably another one of those tricksters trying to play on the weak and the hurting in our society. Those are the kind of people that really, really annoy me, taking advantage of the ones who are weak around us. Don't those annoy you, those kind of people? They annoy me. And here we were. We were told to scourge him. I remember how he came into town. There's a lot of hoopla about that. Everybody in Passover that year was excited about him. They were not just the regular people from Passover that were here, but it was people from all over the region because people were bringing their sick, they're bringing their weak in hopes that this Jesus would somehow touch and heal him. So everybody was looking for Jesus. The place was a madhouse here in Jerusalem, and we were told to be on alert for that. Then, just a week before Jesus arrived, apparently he was outside of town at a place called Bethany, just 2 miles outside of town, and he raised a man from the dead. The man's name was Lazarus. The people said he just went up to the grave and said, "Lazarus, come forth," and the dead man came out of the grave in the grave clothes. I didn't believe it. I figured just another one of those tricks. I heard that Jesus was in tight with Lazarus, that Jesus knew Lazarus' sisters, and this is probably all part of their scheme, just to make Jesus more popular so he could prey on the people. They would give him his money. I'm sure that's what it was. And when Jesus arrived in town, as if he wasn't popular enough already, well, after that resurrection, or bringing someone back to life, rather, everybody wanted to see him. They gave him a royal welcome. They threw down palms. They threw down robes. They hailed him like he was an entering king. When I heard about that, I knew that this Passover would not pass peacefully. This was a direct challenge to the Jewish leaders in the city. The people were shifting their love and allegiance from them to Jesus, and I knew that the Jewish leaders wouldn't tolerate that. I didn't know what would happen, but you could feel the tension in the air in the city. You could almost cut it with a knife. And here we were. We had Jesus. Our job was to scourge him. Well, apparently the Jewish leaders had interviewed him. They had discovered that he was what I suspected all along. He was just a fake, just a trickster trying to connive and hoodwink the people. You know what they told us? They told us that now he was even claiming to be the Son of God. Son of God? I mean, he looked like a man to me. Just a really ordinary man. In fact, he had bags under his eyes. He had been up all night the night before. His hair was disheveled. His robe was sweaty and dirty. He looked like a mess. Son of God? Are you kidding? The guy was nothing more than a dirty man. So we began to do what we are specialists at. We scourged him. We changed his hands above his head. We brought out the cat of nine tails, and at first, the hooks didn't sink into his flesh. At first, it was just the tenderizing, and then they began to sink in. They began to tear large chunks of flesh, and the blood splattered all over the place, and he screamed in agony. Again and again. But I began to get sort of uneasy. You see, it's at this time when criminals' true hearts come out. I told you about that. But his heart wasn't filled with evil. He didn't say a word against us. He didn't swear. He didn't hate us. He was peaceful and gentle and calm, yet he was still in agony as we tortured him. I think my men probably got into this a little bit too much because they couldn't seem to break him down to the point of the evil and darkness to come out of his heart. Eventually, after beating him, they put a crown of thorns on him, and they put a purple robe around him because they said he was supposedly a king of the Jews, and they pressed the crown into his head, and the blood ran down his face. The blood soaked into the purple robe. And my soldiers, they mocked him. They spit in his face. They got on their knees and said, "Oh, king." They made a fool of him. And when they were done, they tore the robe off, tearing open the wounds again because the blood had congealed into the fabric. We sent him back to Pilate, thinking, oh, that would be the end we'd see of him. I don't know what he had ever done, but in my heart I knew it could have been nothing deserving the punishment that we were told to give. His heart, it didn't show evil. Made me really nervous. But it wasn't long, and Pilate sent him back to us. And I couldn't believe what the word was from him. Finish the job. Crucify him. Jesus began to carry his cross out to the place of the skull. It's a mile outside of the city. He could barely make it. The scourging had torn him up so bad. The muscles in the back of his legs were hanging down. The organs, as was often true with scourging, the organs were exposing through the back. We grabbed a man on the side of the road, and he helped us bring the cross, helped Jesus bring the cross out to where we would crucify him. We stretched an arm out, We pounded the nail in. We stretched another arm out and we pounded the nail in. We pounded the nail into the footpiece. We put him up. I felt uneasy, felt wrong. Still, no hatred and evil out of this man's heart. I had never seen this before. Well, surely, I figured, now that he was dangling over death itself, surely the darkness for which the Jewish leaders and Pilate had condemned him for, surely that would come out and we'd see it. But it didn't. In fact, he said something I've never, ever heard before. He said, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do." Forgive us? We've tortured him, made it as painful as we could ever conceive of. We're crucifying him. We're killing him, and he is turning and saying, "Forgive us? We're Roman soldiers. Nobody forgives us. Everybody hates us." Where was this able to come from in this man's heart? I was so uneasy. This is wrong. This man shouldn't be dying on a cross. How did we end up doing this? The Jewish leaders, they had come out to watch him die. And as we were watching him on the cross, waiting for the approaching time of death, I looked at them, and the story became clear. The smirk on their face said it all. He saved others, but he can't save himself. Come on down off the cross, Jesus, and then we'll believe. Then I realized the evil wasn't in Jesus' heart. The evil was in their hearts. He had challenged their power. He had challenged their authority. And they had schemed and connived a way to eliminate this man, Jesus, the man who claimed to be the Son of God. And they had done it with delight and with glee, and the smirk on their face as they watched him die said, "Ha, finally we've got you. The threat to our power and authority is eliminated." I just wanted this crucifixion to be over with. Usually we feel like there was some right or sense of serving society. We're doing the right thing, even though I don't like to watch people die. But I feel like we're repaying a criminal for what they owe, but not this time. I knew this was wrong. It shouldn't take place. As we watched him die, things went from bad to worse. About the sixth hour, darkness covered the entire land. It was like creation itself went into grieving at this man's death. Like a blanket was thrown over the sky. We had never seen anything like this before. It wasn't the time for an eclipse. Where did this darkness come from? An hour passed on to hour. And as the ninth hour approached, we could tell from the light of our torches that this man was coming closer and closer to death. Someone had the bright idea, maybe he was thirsty, so they grabbed a sponge that was filled with vinegar and they stuck it on a stick and tried to shove it in his mouth. You probably don't know what that is. You see, here in Jerusalem, for the public toilets, we use a sponge soaked in vinegar. The vinegar is an antiseptic. That's what they tried to shove in this man's mouth. As the time came closer and closer to death, and the darkness covered the land, it seemed like he gathered his strength, and in one final last phrase, he screamed, "It is finished!" And his head hung. The Jews say that at that time the curtain in the temple tore in two from top to bottom. I don't know about that. I'm not a Jew. I don't know about these healings and these miracles that supposedly he did. Maybe they're true, but I do know this. I saw Jesus die. In fact, I was in charge of his death. I saw his heart, because crucifixion brings out the heart of a man, and there was no evil in it. The next few days were dark days for me. Not because of anything else, but it seemed like the darkness that covered the land from the sixth to ninth hour covered my heart. I pride myself in being a public servant, but here I was filled with shame. I knew this shouldn't have taken place. This man who claimed to be the Son of God, who maybe seemed to be the Son of God, I had been in charge of his death. I was filled with guilt. I was filled with shame. I was filled with darkness at what I had done. Has anyone else ever felt that way? I did. What would I do with it? It seemed like I couldn't shake it. I had killed in the most barbaric way possible the most innocent and pure man I had ever met. And then things really got weird. The 3 days after we crucified him, I began hearing on the streets that Jesus was back. Jesus couldn't be back. I mean, I crucify people for a living. We know they're dead when they come down. In fact, we have a Roman coroner certify their death. Jesus couldn't be alive. I'm sure it was just an empty tomb. Somebody stole the body. But that's not what they were saying. They didn't say he stole the body. They said Jesus was alive. He had appeared to some women. Then he appeared to his disciples, and then he had appeared to, at one point, more than 500, and Jesus was appearing all over town. And I know you're thinking, okay, you're crazy, Felix. Jesus isn't alive. But I have to tell you, at that time, it took more faith to believe that Jesus wasn't alive than he was alive. People were seeing him all over the town, and he was saying, touch my hands, touch my side. He was eating with them. The real Jesus was back. The man who had conquered death for others conquered death himself. Now, I know this is hard to believe, but realize what was happening. People who were his arch enemies, people who didn't believe him at all, his own brothers, James and Jude. If you can get your own brothers to believe your God, then you are really convincing somebody. They went from doubters to believers. They met the risen Jesus, a man who was the arch enemy of the Christians, who had gone out of the way to kill and persecute Christians, a man named Paul. He met the risen Jesus and went from being a detractor from the faith to one of the most outspoken proponents for Jesus Christ. The Jews who had followed the law for thousands of years, they left the law and began worshiping Jesus, saying that he was the fulfillment of the law that they had been following for thousands of years. It was all about the risen Jesus. The Jews, they worship on Saturday, and they had done that for thousands of years. They knew that to not worship on Saturday was to risk eternal condemnation. Yet guess what day they started gathering these people who are following Jesus? On Sunday, the first day of the week, the day that Jesus rose. Jesus seemed to change everything in Jerusalem. Nobody argued over the fact that he was alive because he appeared so many times to so many people. People I talked with one day in the city streets who were mocking the idea of a risen Jesus. I talked to them 48 hours later and they'd come back swearing, I met him. I touched him. He is alive. That really scared me. He's back. And he's appearing to people. Certainly he's going to appear to me. I killed him. It's not going to be pretty. So I went and I found the group of Christians. And I asked them, what would my fate be with Jesus? And they said the most incredible thing. They said that when Jesus had died on that cross, it was God's set plan and God's set foreknowledge. And what God had done as he died on the cross is he had taken the sin, the shame, and the guilt of everyone who had trusted him as Savior and make him their king and had placed it on Jesus. And he had died for us. They called it a great exchange. That he had taken the sin and guilt and shame of all who would trust in him as Savior and King and died for their sin on the cross. But there was an exchange that all of the goodness, the holiness, and the purity of who Jesus was would be given to all those who would have him as their Savior and their King. You mean I can get rid of this feeling of shame? This feeling of darkness, this Jesus can take away? And I could have a heart like the heart of the purest and holiest man I've ever met? I didn't know if that was really true. It sounds sort of far-fetched. So I got down on my knees right there with those Christians. And I called out to God and I said, God, I don't understand. I don't understand all of these things. But if there is hope, Jesus, I ask you to be my Savior. And Jesus, be my King. I know this is hard for you to believe, but things changed. In that moment, it felt like a sponge had been put into my heart. And it soaked away all of the blackness and the darkness. And I knew in that moment I was forgiven. Not only that, but as the days and weeks that followed, the things I used to love to do, I didn't want to do them anymore. It's like God had changed the very desires of my heart. I felt like I was thinking more and more like this man called Jesus. I know what you're saying. You're saying, Felix, it's just some kind of psychosomatic little trip that you went through and it was just a big mind game. Well, folks, let me tell you, my friends, you can call it a mind game, but nobody argues over the fact that Jesus is alive. That's the facts. No one here in Jerusalem disputes it. There is no body. And he's risen. You know, I think back oftentimes to that day when we crucified him. Pilate had us do what is often our custom, to take and to put on top of the cross the charges for which we are crucifying a man. The charges that we were to put on the cross that day was that he was the King of the Jews. I think, though, that we should have put on the cross that day not what we accused him of, but what he actually did for us. And he rose from the dead to prove that he did it. Jesus came to pay in full for our sin. And he's alive. That's how he proves it. My friends, Jesus paid in full for all of our sin, all of our guilt, all of our shame. It really happened. He's alive.
The same power that raised Jesus from the dead will one day raise us to new life forever. Let's sing about that.
Jesus has overcome.